It's early 1964. The Beatles are about to take America by storm.
The Beatles, bring them on!
Bonanza is all the rage on television. Cassius Clay, soon to be known as Muhammad Ali, is set for a big-time heavyweight showdown with Sonny Liston.
15 stone 8, Cassius Clay, 15 stone and half a pound. He's giving away 7.5 pounds to the champion, Cassius Clay.
And in Congress, the Civil Rights Act is finally winding its way towards becoming law.
Ever to be written into the law, and thus reaffirms the conception of equality for all men that began with Lincoln and the Civil War.
Meanwhile, federal officials operating under orders from President Lyndon B. Johnson are working to implement a series of new tariffs. This is the latest volley in a slow-burning trade war between the U.S. and an early version of the European Union. Now, as culturally defining events go, those tariffs are almost certainly not the first thing that springs to mind when you think about 1964. But while the Beatles and Muhammad Ali and certainly the Civil Rights Act deserve their place in history, those tariffs have had an underappreciated impact too. And that's especially true if you've bought a pickup truck anytime in the past 60 years. Because those tariffs have warped the American market for trucks, giving a leg up to a handful of brands, secretly hiking prices for consumers, and inspiring some wild attempts at tax evasion. I'm Eric Baim, and you're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market wants to drive you straight to prosperity and how the government keeps throwing up roadblocks. Over the past 4 weeks, we've looked at how trade restrictions, like tariffs, benefit politically connected industries, how consumers end up paying the price, and how those policies can have unintended consequences that often persist due to lobbying and political inertia. Today's episode will combine all of that. This is one of the most infamous stories about why we can't have nice things, and it's a story that actually doesn't start with pickup trucks at all. It starts with frozen chicken.
Well, you run into the chicken tax pretty early on in studying U.S. trade policy, and then the story and how it relates to chickens is part of trade lore.
This is Dan Griswold.
I've been in the Washington policy arena for close to 25 years. I'm currently mostly retired, but currently an outside adjunct scholar with the Cato Institute.
The story of the chicken tax actually starts with a tax on chickens, on American chickens specifically, which were being exported to Europe in large volumes in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Today, we think of chicken as a cheap, ubiquitous meat, but back then, chicken was still a delicacy in Europe. And after World War II, a sudden influx of cheaper frozen chicken from the U.S. did not sit well with French and German farmers.
We call it the European Union today, but back then it was the European Economic Community, and they were just launching what I would call that great fiasco known as the Common Agricultural Policy. And it led to a tripling of the tariff on U.S. poultry exports to Europe.
Those tariffs set off a series of negotiations between governments on both sides of the Atlantic, even amid seemingly far more serious issues like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the ongoing Cold War. It was chicken tariffs that were constantly on President John F. Kennedy's plate. German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer once claimed that about half of the conversations he had with JFK were about chicken. By December of 1963, just after Johnson assumed the presidency, those negotiations had clearly failed.
They were kind of locked into their common agricultural policies. LBJ had a lot on his plate back then, but he had enough time to sign Presidential Proclamation 3564, and that imposed retaliatory tariffs against the Europeans. They targeted four things: brandy, potato starch, dextrin, which is a derivative of cornstarch, and light trucks, which at the time mostly came from Germany, from Volkswagen.
We found a wonderful bargain, a little Beetle Volkswagen. He came all the way from Germany.
You know, this tariff on pickup trucks or cargo vehicles, it just happened to be because the original chicken trade war was with Germany and France. So Germany was building these vans, and they said, okay, let's put a tariff on those vans. If it was a different country, it might have been something else.
This is Jordan Golson, a freelance reporter who has written extensively about the automobile market for a wide range of publications.
Wired, The Verge, Popular Mechanics, almost every car publication at some point.
He's fascinated by the chicken tax and some of the weird ways that it has altered the landscape of the American pickup truck market, often in ways that most of us don't think about.
You know, I think the weirdest thing about this is that pickup trucks have very little to do with chicken. What's called the chicken tax now was basically aimed at German-built Volkswagen vans, and that is what he was trying to protect the U.S. from, or really, he was trying to retaliate against the Germans to protect chicken farmers. And the key thing here for light truck is that it's a cargo vehicle, whereas a passenger vehicle is okay. If you wanted to build a pickup truck to sell it here in America, you could either build it here in America or build it somewhere else and pay a 25% or have a car that costs 25% more, right? Because it's that government tariff. So it's a tax.
A 25% tariff is a huge trade barrier. If you've got a $50,000 truck, it's now suddenly a $62,000 truck. And that extra money is just going into the U.S. Treasury.
We have a 2.5% tariff on automobiles coming in. That's 2.5% too high, but it's still kind of a nuisance. But 25% is a real tariff that has basically stifled imports of light trucks.
That tariff was aimed at Europe, Germany specifically, but it applied to all imports of light trucks from everywhere in the world.
They didn't just aim it at imports from Volkswagen. It had a universal application, so all imports, they happened to be mostly coming from Germany at the time, but the world's changed a lot since then. But the bottom line is now imports from Thailand or Japan or Europe, they're all taxed. Of light trucks, they're all taxed at 25%.
And while the tariff directly increased the price of imported trucks, its existence causes the price of domestically produced trucks to rise too.
We pay more for the domestically produced trucks because the domestic producers have more pricing power. And Eric, we also pay from a lack of competition, a lack of having as many choices as we should have.
The American pickup truck market is dominated by a handful of brands, thanks in no small part to these tariffs. In fact, there's a huge difference between the U.S. market for sedans and the U.S. market for pickup trucks.
Americans, for as much as people say they want to buy American and all that, we are perfectly happy to buy German cars, Swedish cars, Japanese cars, Korean cars, lots of cars built in Korea these days.
The comparison to the sedan market is an important one, one that we'll come back to later, because it's not as if a lack of tariffs on imported cars has been a problem for America. The car manufacturing supply chains are truly global these days, and there's a wide range of choice and competitive prices within the sedan market.
And so, you know, the argument that, oh, we need to protect domestic industry from scary pickup trucks built elsewhere, you know, is a little questionable, and you wonder what the market would look like if it was more free and fair and competitive.
What would that pickup truck market look like? Well, it might look something like the Subaru Brat, one of the most famous victims of the chicken tax.
There have been a number of weird results of this as the restriction applied to cargo vehicles. And so Subaru, which very small company today as car companies go, still very small back in the 70s, they were looking to sell a truck called the Brat, B-R-A-T, for Bi-Drive Recreational All-Terrain Transporter. Brat is a much better name. But it was a pickup truck.
I'm not convinced that Brat is a great name for a truck, but okay, let's just go with it.
It compares to what today would be like the Ford Maverick, which is, it's not a huge truck, it's not for towing or whatever.
The Brat was trying to fit into a world that didn't have what we think of as modern SUVs.
But it's like, whatever the 1970s equivalent of, let's go to Home Depot and buy some plants and put them in the back of the truck. That's what they were going for. Small companies like Subaru, especially back then, can afford to get a little weird, and so you get cars like the Brat. Then you can look at other things like the car that inspired that, the El Camino. People remember that car much more than any other car of the era because it was a little different. It was a little odd. It was something people hadn't seen before.
Different and odd can be good things, especially when you're a relatively small company like Subaru and you're trying to break into a new market. In fact, the Brat was successful enough that an American president actually owned one.
Ronald Reagan at his ranch in California had a Brat, and that sort of, you know, shows what it was for. He used it as a farm truck, you know, to drive around the ranch, and it was perfect for that sort of thing. It has, you know, four-wheel drive, and it's not too big, but it is, I believe, at the Reagan Ranch and has been restored to its former glory. You can go see it.
But like all Brats sold in the U.S., Reagan's has one noticeable and unusual feature.
So in order to sell it here, they said, okay, it's a cargo vehicle, but we need to make it a passenger vehicle, and then it's exempt from the tariff. So they put seats facing backwards in the cargo bed with seat belts and grab handles. Which is bonkers.
Seats. Actual car seats in the bed of a pickup truck.
I'm sure some 10-year-olds had a grand old time sitting in the back. I mean, I've ridden in the back of a pickup truck, but I've never ridden in the back of seats that were welded in place, which seems pretty awesome, but that's, you know, it was not the intent of the vehicles.
And no, this wasn't a regular feature of the Brat.
No, the whole point of the seats was to, you know, they didn't sell the seats anywhere else. That sort of says everything you need to know.
There's actually a long and glorious history of companies doing this sort of thing, altering a product for the explicit purpose of avoiding paying import taxes. It even has a name, tariff engineering. And it's actually legal. Back in the 1880s, American tariffs on imported sugar were based on the color of the product because refined sugar was white and less well-refined sugar would be darker. So one importer dodged those tariffs by adding a little bit of molasses to refined sugar, turning it brown. Eventually, the authorities got wind of the scheme, but that importer took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in 1881 that altering the color of the sugar to avoid paying tariffs was totally legal. In the opinion, Justice Joseph Bradley laid out reasoning that's pretty hard to argue with.
Great stress is laid on the charge that sugars are manufactured in dark colors on purpose to evade our duties. Suppose this is true. Has not a manufacturer a right to make his goods as he pleases? If they are less marketable, it is his loss. If they are not less marketable, who has a right to complain?
Tariff engineering is the reason why Chuck Taylor sneakers have that thin layer of felt on the bottoms of the soles. Because it allows them to be imported as slippers, and therefore subject to a lesser tariff than the tax that we apply to imported sneakers. And there are numerous other examples, particularly in the clothing and textile industries, where, as we covered in a previous episode on this podcast, some of the highest U.S. tariff rates reside. The higher the tariff, the more there is to be gained by gaming the system. And the Brat isn't the only example in the auto industry either.
One of those is a small van called the Transit Connect. You may have seen the Ford Transit around. They're hugely popular. The Transit Connect is sort of a smaller city-sized version of that. Very popular in Europe and less popular here. And so production lines are really expensive. And when you have a product like that that's not particularly popular in a geographic area, it doesn't make sense to build it there. It makes more sense to build it somewhere else and ship it. But the chicken tax was specifically designed to stop vehicles like these, because at the time it was small German vans from coming into the U.S.
Now, however, it's a small van built in Europe by Ford, an American company, that's running into this same barrier.
So to get around this, Ford, cleverly or stupidly, depending on your perspective, installed seats in the back of its van, and like with the Brat, poof, magically, it is no longer a cargo van, it's a passenger van.
Well, at least until it clears customs.
Those vans got shipped to the United States, where Ford promptly yanked out the rear seats and sold it as a cargo vehicle.
If the legacy of the chicken tax was just that imported cars had to jump through some strange and costly hoops to be sold here, it would be bad enough. But there are other vehicles that never make it into the American market because it's just not economical to go through the work of dodging the tariff structure.
There's a small, or I guess it's a mid-sized truck from Volkswagen called, I think it's the Anorak, which is a very interesting pickup truck that they build overseas. They do not sell it here. The Toyota Hilux is one of the like top three best-selling pickups in the entire world. You cannot get it here. We get a version of it, which is the Toyota Tacoma, but it's not the same. And so you can't buy a Toyota Hilux built in Japan if you think that that's great and that's super reliable. You know, we just don't get that here. And so there is that, which is a very direct cost.
It's a very direct cost with very obvious beneficiaries, the existing brands that build pickup trucks in the United States.
The big three are so dominant. If you look at the trucks out on the road today, they're Ford F-Series, Dodge Ram, and Chevy Silverados and Sierras. We've got three providers that dominate the market, and the U.S. government is artificially constricting competition in that market. And that means higher prices. It means less choice.
It means other things, too. Toyota has successfully broken into the U.S. pickup truck market by locating manufacturing facilities here rather than importing trucks like the Hilux from overseas. But that's a huge barrier that most truck manufacturers simply won't be able to clear.
If a foreign producer wants to kind of test a light truck that they think American consumers would be interested in, they can't import 20,000 of them to see how they do because the 25% tariff is almost prohibitive. They have to set up production here. Well, you and I can't just set up an auto plant and start selling things. You're talking hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of investment. So it keeps out more, if I can say, entrepreneurial producers from testing the U.S. market. So it's just a losing proposition all around for American consumers and the American economy.
An advocate for protectionist trade policies might look at this and come away with a different conclusion. Isn't it good that American trade policy effectively forces foreign companies like Toyota to locate manufacturing facilities here if they want to sell their trucks here? Doesn't that mean we're bringing more jobs to America? But that's missing half the picture, says Griswold. There would be more trucks, greater variety, more competition, and most importantly, lower prices without the chicken tax. And all of that would make investment more likely. That's not theoretical. Remember, there's a much lower tariff on imported cars. So we have a perfect illustration of what the alternate reality would look like, the reality where there's no chicken tax.
Just look at the car market, for example, because while we have a 2.5% tariff, that doesn't have a huge impact. Foreign producers have continued to invest robustly here in the United States. Mercedes-Benz and BMW, they have very busy facilities in South Carolina and Alabama and elsewhere, investing billions in these factories here in the United States. I think you'd see the same dynamic with light trucks. Let's say we even took the tariff down to 2.5% to match vehicles. You would have more imports from South Korea and maybe Thailand and other places in Japan. But mostly what you'd see, Eric, is more investment here in the United States and maybe from some new players who have test marketed their trucks and realize there's an appetite here for it. So we are cutting ourselves off from a robust international market in pickup trucks, and consumers are paying for it every day, even though unfortunately the cost is largely, it's real but unseen.
Back in 1964, no one could have known how the chicken tax was going to warp future markets for pickup trucks. But it's not an accident that the tax remains in place. Remember what we said at the start. The tariffs imposed by LBJ covered several different items: brandy, potato starch, a specific type of corn starch, and light trucks. Well, we don't still charge higher import taxes on three of those four things.
All of the other tariffs related to this trade war are gone except for this one, because this specific one was beneficial to a number of very powerful companies.
The heads of those companies won't publicly admit that they like the chicken tax. In fact, they'd prefer just not to talk about it much at all.
I'm the wrong guy to ask that question, because I would not have the chicken tax, but that's just my view.
That's Sergio Marchionne, the then CEO of Fiat Chrysler, talking to NPR's Sonari Glinton in 2015.
Oh, why not? I mean, you're the right person to answer. You're in charge of an American car company that benefits.
Do I need the chicken tax? The answer is no.
They may not need the chicken tax, but it's pretty obvious that no one is really agitating to get rid of it either. If the car makers wanted it gone, it probably would be. After all, the other tariffs imposed by LBJ in 1963 have been off the books for a while.
We've long gotten past that dispute. The original rationale for it has long vanished. The tariffs on brandy and starch disappeared, but here we are 60 years later talking about the 25% tariff on light trucks.
This has stayed in place because there are a few people highly invested in keeping it around, and no one really cares to get rid of it.
In short, one reason to avoid trade wars is that you never know what weird and unintended consequences they might produce.
It's not easy to make one of these rules, but it's 1,000 times harder to get rid of one.
Yeah, you know, the joke about a temporary government program, this is seems to be pretty permanent right now.
It's one of those trade stories that, you know, you read about and you're like, okay, number one, how did that happen in the first place? And number two, how is it still around 50 years later? And here we are.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You've been listening to episode 5 of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, a 6-part podcast series about how the free market wants to deliver the goods for consumers and about how government keeps screwing it all up. Next week, in our final episode, we'll take a look at a real live example of protectionism in action, something that's happening right now in the halls of Washington, D.C., where bureaucrats at the International Trade Commission and the Department of Commerce are deciding whether they should hike tariffs, and therefore prices, on cans of soup, beans, and lots of other products that you buy at the store. All of this because one company, yes, one single company, wants it to happen. And you won't believe how that process plays out. It's a quintessential example of why we can't have nice things. This week's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty. The role of Justice Joseph Bradley was played by Austin Bragg. Audio mixing by Ian Kaiser and fact-checking by Catherine Seifer. Our executive editor is Jim Epstein. Special thanks to our guests on this week's episode, Dan Griswold and Jordan Golson. For more on the chicken tax, check out Griswold's work at Cato.org and look for Golson's 2014 piece in Wired magazine, Cheap American Chicken Gave Us This Weird Subaru Pickup. Do you have a favorite car?
It's always a fun question. My favorite car is the Rolls-Royce Ghost, which is also one of the most expensive, but there is a reason it's $500,000. It's handmade, hand-stitched. The leather feels like butter. It's just outrageous. And, you know, does anyone need a $500,000 car? No. But if I had $500,000 and I wanted to buy a car, that's the one I would get.
So Rolls-Royce Ghost number one, Subaru Brat number two. That's
exactly.
I assume your rankings.
Yeah, that's the perfect garage right there. You're ready for any eventuality. Volkswagen.